Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of the performing arts here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today you'll be hearing about the Spreckels Theater Company's production of The Light in the Piazza from musical director Diego Garcia and soprano Jennifer Mitchell. Paul Flight, artistic director of the California Bach Society, will talk about Bohemian composer Jans Dietmas Zelenka, whose Misa Votiva will be performed this weekend. Choreographer Risa Jarislow and composer Scott Johnson is joined by musician Paul Drescher to talk about the music for the West Coast premiere of Jarislow's Resist Surrender at ODC Theater. And dancemaker Kim Epifano is in the house to talk about her San Francisco trolley dances along this year's route, the Muni T Line. Stay tuned. This weekend, ODC Theater is home to Risa Jarislow and dancers performing the West Coast premiere of Resist Surrender and the world premiere of Four Dialogues, a solo dance that will be danced by Jarislow. I'm pleased to be joined in studio by three of the main creative forces behind the performances of Resist Surrender: Risa, Scott Johnson, and Paul Drescher. Risa recently relocated to the Bay Area after a long career dancing, choreographing, and teaching in New York. Her company has been presented at most of the venues for New Dance in New York City, as well as nationally and internationally in Russia and Dublin. She and her dancers have led movement workshops for survivors of domestic violence, new speakers of English, women with disabilities, and other marginalized people. Risa, welcome to KLW and Open Air.
Thank you.
Composer-guitarist Scott Johnson has been a pioneering voice in the new relationship being forged between the classical tradition and the popular culture that surrounds it. He was an early advocate of using rock instruments and technology in scored composition and has appeared as a virtuosic electric guitarist in many of his pieces. Scott's music has been commissioned and performed internationally by ensembles such as the Kronos Quartet and the Bang on a Can All-Stars, as well as his own groups. Scott, welcome to Open Air.
Pleasure to be here.
And finally, living Bay Area institution Paul Drescher has been a part of the mix here, and he and the Paul Drescher Ensemble will be performing Scott's score live for the performances. For nearly 30 years, the Paul Drescher Ensemble has been a creative force, an active member, or shall I say, hyperactive member of the San Francisco Bay Area, as well as the national arts community. Always a pleasure to have you back, Paul, as well.
It's great to be here, David.
Risa, this is the first time, I understand, not the first time, that you've incorporated non-dancers into your work.
Right.
Explain to me why you wanted to do that.
I find that bringing together highly trained dancers and people who are not trained creates a very exciting performance. I think in the process of making work, when you bring those two groups together, everybody grows. Everybody finds something new in themselves. And it makes for work that every audience can relate to, can connect to. And I find it tremendously satisfying to work with that kind of mixed group.
In this particular occasion, you're exploring the perception of masculinity. How are you doing that?
Well, let me just say that I came to this. What got me interested in exploring this was living through my son's young adolescent period. And
I see knowing smiles all around the room.
But at that point, I just began to think about this. Well, you know, what is maleness? What is masculinity in this culture? And could it be different? And how could it be different? And one thing that struck me was that I think that it has a lot to do with what I see as a kind of collective ambivalence about power. We want it. We don't want it. We respect it in other people, but resent it. And I think that has a lot to do with the definition of traditional gender roles. So I wanted to explore that in this piece, and I wanted to not just comment on it, but find a way for the dancers to have to really grapple with that conflict every time they do the piece. So there are sections of the piece that are always a little bit different. I don't know how they're going to play out, which makes for very exciting performance.
Well, I was going to ask, what is the interaction between the dancers and the non-dancers, or is it a matter of them just making sure they stay out of each other's way?
No. I think that what happened as the piece evolved, although I did not set out to do this, but what happened was that the dancers became the resist, and the men became the surrender, and the men kind of save the dancers from themselves. The men provide ease. They take care of them. The dancers have some extremely vigorous, intensely physical movement, and the men sort of calm them and take them out of it and bring a gentleness to it.
Scott, in reading about how you've created the score, I'm completely fascinated. Let's have it a little listen to something you did for your own ensemble, and then we'll talk about the special music you created specifically for Risa's project. This is music of Scott Johnson.
Yeah, this is from a piece called Americans, and it's the voice of a Chinese woman talking about some of her first impressions when she got here.
Americans all look the same to me. Same to me. Americans all look the same to me. When I first got, Americans all look the same to me. Same to me. All look the same. All look the same. Same. Americans all look the same. Same. When I first got here. Americans all look the same to me. I just saw, look the same, and the first got here.
An excerpt from Scott Johnson's Americans, a similar technique being employed by Scott for Risa Jaroslaw's Resist Surrender. Tell me about what you're using in Risa's piece, Scott.
Well, in Risa's piece, we actually got many, many recordings of men in different situations and different professions, different backgrounds. Much more than I could possibly use. We wound up using New York City firemen. I recorded a lengthy poker game with Risa's husband and some very animated compatriots. And we recorded also some corporate lawyers. And what I do when I make these recordings, I basically analyze the pitches and the rhythms. I just write them down approximately of the people's speech, and then I use those as melodies, and I construct instrumental scores around these themes that I take from the voices, and then I use the recorded voices in those pieces with the instruments accompanying them.
Risa, did you have some input into the types of people you wanted to make sure was represented?
Yes, I did. We did those interviews together. Scott recorded them. There were some other groups as well. We met with two people who worked with men who were batterers, We interviewed a group of trans men. Not all of the recordings made it into the final piece, but the interviews were fascinating. And it was Scott's interest in using text that drew me to him, to his work for this piece.
Paul Drescher, I'm wondering if you had some input with Scott on how best to have these sounds come out, or were you more you executing Scott's work?
We're here just executing Scott's work and coordinating it with Risa's choreography and dancers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've known Scott since the early 80s. We sort of first came into the contemporary music community at the same time, and we're often grouped together on the same festivals because we were both identified first with being guitarists. And so I've wanted to work with Scott and play his music for a long time. So when Risa approached me about this project, which was through, I think, a recommendation from Margie Jenkins, I said, and Margie gave Risa a very, strong stamp of approval, saying this woman does great choreography. And so I believe Margie, who I've worked with for 30 years myself, and I knew Scott's work, and it was pretty much easy for me to say yes to being just having my group be the performers, the musicians for this project.
Mm-hmm. The Drescher Ensemble is a fairly fluid ensemble. What are we going to hear live as part of this group?
Well, Scott scored this for a quartet, so it's cello. It's Crystal Pascucci on cello, Lisa Mezzacapa on upright bass and electric bass, Maria Mutru on piano, my regular pianist, is regular in almost all my ensembles, and John Schott on electric guitar, who's, I call him my doppelganger, because when I'm not taking the electric guitar part, even though we don't look at all like, John often is playing the parts that I once played. But in this case, I haven't played this part.
I didn't play most of this either. I was very happy to torture other guitarists.
And I'm actually been, because there's some technical complexities about mixing the voices and coordinating all that in performance, I've been, because my band, my regular band is we call it electroacoustic band. We use a lot of electronic technology. So it was very easy for us to drop Scott's technical demands into our normal performance setup. So I think it's also a very good match for this, because some ensembles, a regular chamber music ensemble, might have some challenge putting all those pieces together and making it work easily, and it's a natural for us because that's what we do all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is a very good fit with Paul because as Paul said, we've been in some ways the East Coast and West Coast guitar guys guitar composer guys when it was rather unusual and not terribly well accepted in the contemporary classical music world. And so Paul and I have been using the same tools in many ways all of our careers, so it's a very good fit. We both understand this idea of merging score-based, the inheritance of the classical world together with the American vernacular. We both played in rock bands when we were teenagers. And this, fortunately, is an attitude that I think is spreading in the younger generation. It's no longer rare. It's not a fight anymore.
Yeah, we're not unique at all anymore.
No, not anymore. it was great when we were more
we're not
more
getting those
distinguished
gigs anymore.
No, we're like old school here.
That's composer Scott Johnson. Paul Drescher will be executing his music for Risa Jaroslaw and Dancers ODC presentation of the West Coast premiere of Resist Surrender, ODC on 17th Street here in San Francisco. Information at odcdance.org. Thanks so much for coming in today, and we look forward to these performances.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Still to come, you'll learn about the Spreckles Theater Company's production of The Light in the Piazza. You'll learn about the Bohemian composer Zelenka from Paul Flight, director of the Cal Bach Society. Plus, more with Kim Epifano about San Francisco trolley dances, all ahead on Open Air. Well, while we're on the dance segment of Open Air this week, and coincidentally also involving ODC, the 12th annual season of San Francisco Trolley Dances leaves the station this Saturday and Sunday. This year's route will follow Muni's T-Line from Mission Bay to the Bayview. More than a half a dozen site-specific performances are currently programmed, including works by Bay Area choreographers Beeb Chanel Bibene, Alex Ketley, Amy Seiwert, and San Francisco Trolley Dance's artistic director, Kim Epifano, who joins me in studio. Kim has a 30-year history as an award-winning choreographer, director, performer, vocalist, educator, and collaborator. Among her many accolades, she recently received the Gerbode Choreography Award with the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco, who are presenting and commissioning The Last Blue Couch in the Sky in 2017. This is her 29th year co-directing the Mud Butt Mystery Theater Troupe with Sally Davis, a group she has traveled all over the world with. I'm dying to hear more about that, Kim. And lots of information about Kim is at epiphanydance.org. And Kim, if you are, it seems like we're dedicated to you today here on KLW.
To us. Thank
as
you.
Earlier this morning on our morning edition Cross Currents report, we had a report about last year's trolley project for which we also talked. So welcome back, Kim.
Thank you for having me back.
So what made you guys choose the T-Line this time around?
Well, every year I try and do a new route. We have taken the T-Line before, twice before, but we always do a new beginning and new ending. So we're going the furthest out we've ever been. What drew me back there is I went into the Bayview Library. And inside the library, there's a beautiful room in there called the Wisdom Walk Room. And it's actually an outside room inside. So the room's surrounded by glass. And when I went in there, it was so moving and beautiful. It has the Dinkra symbols all along the walkway, or which are from West Africa, that all have sort of like proverbs and spiritual. They are printed onto cloth.
Well, there's got to be inspiration there.
Yeah, sure. And I went in there, and there's two beautiful Japanese maples and a bench in the walkway. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is just waiting for a dance to happen. So the libraries have been so supportive. I've worked with Michelle Jeffers before and Beverly Hayes from the library in the Bayview. And I asked her, you know, could we use it as a site? And she was very supportive and she said yes. So once I had that, you know, I had that, then I find other sites. The YMCA was a block away. The Opera House, Bayview Opera House, is only a couple blocks away, and there's a beautiful garden they're trying to, I'd say, bring to life. And then I thought, okay, well, what? I actually worked backwards this year. And then I thought, okay, where can we start? And that's when I found the new Southern Police Station and the All Is Well Bell, the First Responder Plaza.
Oh, I biked by that. I was
wondering
what that
nobody knows what's going on there, but it is a new San Francisco Arts Commission commissioned Paul Koss to do a basically make a plaza there called First Responder Plaza. And there's a beautiful bell called the All Is Well Bell, and it rings once a day at 12 noon.
I had no idea. Yeah. Did you get to ring it?
No, it rings by itself. Oh. Something I can't control is the bell.
Well, you know, if you had a hammer.
And then, actually, I went to the Bayview Boat Club. I saw that, and then the Bayview Boat Club is a dear place to me because I used to live on Potrero Hill for 20 years, and I feel like it's an old, wonderful holdout. It's the old yellow house. It actually got moved, I don't know, from it was a little bit south, and it got moved to there years ago, and it's now the Bayview Boat Club. And I thought, these people must remember me. I had a cast party here. I had a 40th birthday party here. I love this place. They're holding out. They're not going away. And so I met with them, and Mary Buckman and the other people there, the members, got behind what we were doing. They wanted more people to see who they are and that they are still there, and that it's important that they're still there. And they've been very generous, and we're starting there. That's the starting point. And also, we have a site there, and that's where Imagery, Amy Seiwert's group, is. And then I got working with the Bayview Commons, which is just across the street. And those are the sort of the parks that are right around in that area. So then the people get on the Mission Rock stop from there, and then they go back out to the Bayview. So that's how it's working this year.
Well, you've been doing this for 12 years now. What has been the most unusual reaction of bystanders that you've witnessed in your various sites?
Oh, we've gotten everything from ecstatic reaction to angry reaction to historic information coming from people. I think my most memorable was when we were in the Bayview, for me, and we were at on the front of City College at Evans Branch, and I had like 12 dancers, and we did the whole front. We did on the front of the building and everywhere, and with live music. And
this man came up from the neighborhood, a preacher, and he came up to me. He said, "What are you doing here?" And he watched the whole show. And then afterwards, and he said, and we were saying the history of the Bayview in the piece. And afterwards, he said, "You're making history." And that was such an incredible moment as a director and a choreographer of, oh my gosh, he sees we're making an impact here, and we're making history as we're talking about the history. So that was very moving, because I feel like we really do honestly impact neighborhoods where we go. It's such a long process for me to meet the community members in the neighborhoods and for them to let us in there. I mean, it's hard for somebody to understand. Like if I said to you, "Hey, I want to do a dance in here.
I want to dance on your roof."
Yeah. And what is that? Sure, go ahead. But people don't understand. It's people, you know, performance and people coming in and out and sound systems and rehearsals. So it's a huge undertaking. So it's a lot of generosity that happens from a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So the
troupe, let's just get this straight. You're actually all starting together? Is that correct? And then you have specific stops along the T-line,
yes,
where they're preset pieces ready to go.
It works in tours. So you get a tour guide, and if you're on the 11 o'clock tour, there'd probably be like 60 to 80 people. You get a wristband. You got to come early, because some people come early birds, so they get on the tour they want. And then we take you on that tour. We'll go into the Bayview Boat Club. It's beautiful. It's right on the bay. It's so hard to get sights on the bay. And then we go to the Bayview Commons, where Alex Kexley is, and then they will take you to Zoe Bender for the All Is Well Bell, take you to the Mission Rock Stop, and you follow that same group all the way with that tour guide, and then we take you out to the Bayview. You'll see a dance in the garden by Kinandanda Dance at Mandel Plaza, and then you'll see Sheena Johnston at a mural on the way to the library, and then the library, the Bayview Library, where I am with Yamichi Dance. And then out to the YMCA, where they'll see Cielo Vertical Dance, Heather Bear's Vertical Dance Company.
Neat.
So that happens 6 times a day.
Wow.
On Saturday and Sunday, starting every 45 minutes.
That's amazing.
But people don't have to be with us. You can come and see things, and there's a great bike path this year to ride from the Bayview to the from the Mission Bay to the Bayview. You can drive your own car. The only one that might be hard to get into if you don't have a wristband would be the first site, because we sort of have to monitor how many people go into the site. Most of the other ones, as long as you can see, you're welcome to stay there and watch with us.
So how many total dancers are involved in these various troupes? It's different people are performing at these different stops, right?
Yes, each group, probably I'd say each group has 2 to 8 people in them. So it just varies per site. Like the last one, the vertical dance, is a duet. It's a tall yellow wall, and that's really all you can fit on there. But it's such a thrill to see these dancers dancing on the side of the wall out there. It's drawn a lot of attention.
It must be a lot of inspiration to just seeing, oh, I could do a flip off of this particular aspect of a building, or
yes,
here's a railing I could, you know.
Now, railings are tricky. Some people will let you use railings, some people won't.
Well, find out which ones are being used this weekend for this 12th annual San Francisco Trolley Dances, getting underway, leaves the station this weekend, the 17th and the 18th, mm-hmm, talking with Kim Epifano. Information for these really wonderful day. What a wonderful way to spend the weekend.
It is.
EpiphanyDance.org. Kim, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have you on, again on the air on KLW. We can't catch you off.
I know it.
Very pleased to welcome back Paul Flight, director of the California Box Society, who is bringing to Bay Area ears the wonderful music of Jans Dietmas Zelenka, a true bohemian composer born just outside of Prague in 1679, and who may be less prominent in our 21st century concert programs, but someone who was no less than J.S. Bach held in very high esteem. Cal Bach presents Zelenka's Misa Votiva in San Francisco tomorrow night, Saturday in Palo Alto, and Sunday in Berkeley as its opening work for their 45th anniversary season. Paul Flight has become well-respected for bringing lesser-known Baroque masterworks to the Bay Area stages since his appointment as artistic director at Cal Bach in 2006. He's also the artistic director of Schola Cantorum in San Francisco and the founding director of Berkeley-based Cora Nova. He has twice been a visiting professor of music at UC Berkeley and has been a visiting professor at Mills College, where he has lectured on opera and music history as well as form. No stranger to contemporary repertoire, he is much sought after for his countertenor skills and has performed works by John Adams, Leonard Bernstein, and Unsuk Chin with, among others, such ensembles as the L.A. Philharmonic, the Cleveland Orchestra, the BBC Scottish Symphony, and the Berkeley Symphony. Welcome back to KALW, Paul.
Thank you, David. Delighted to be here.
Well, why do you suppose that, given this composer's prolific output, that he's still kind of on the fringes of the mainstream and only really familiar to more hardcore fans of the Baroque?
Well, there still is the tendency here on the West Coast, well, really through the country, to program only the most well-known of the 18th century composers, Bach and Handel. Perhaps a little bit of Telemann creeps in here and there. But Zelenka is now becoming increasingly prominent in the programs of European groups. And there's a special group that's devoted itself to performing Zelenka's music. And so now we're seeing a huge rise in consciousness about Zelenka, a wonderful composer working just 70 miles away from Bach in Dresden, where he was a court composer for August the Strong. Apparently, August was both August and strong.
And musical.
His chief accomplishment, I suppose, is he consolidated his power by converting to Catholicism, which enabled him to also have dominion over Poland. And so he converted his 17th century theater into a church. And so at the court of Dresden, there was a lot of Catholic church music making going on in an overwhelmingly Lutheran area.
Interesting. And he kind of got in his own way in terms of his legacy and publicity. He had no children. He never married. And I understand from the program notes at the Carl Bach Society website that he was kind of a curmudgeon.
Yes, apparently he wasn't particularly easy to deal with. I think he was also disillusioned because August the Strong really enjoyed his music and he rose to prominence during that time. But upon August's death, the new Elector of Saxony was more interested in Italian music and composers in the writing in the new style. And Zelenka was relegated to a minor position and really became bitter in those later years. And in fact, his late pieces, one of which is the Misa Votiva, he never heard a performance of it. It was written in 1739, and there are a number of masses that have only recently been performed.
Well, it's hard to believe in this day of instant gratification where a composer can just program a synthesizer to hear whatever work that he never heard in public or out loud, something that he committed to paper.
And it's a similar situation with Bach and his B minor mass. There are sections that he also never heard performed in his lifetime.
Well, he was a teacher of the flutist-composer Johann Joachim Quavance, who I know quite well, and who was Frederick the Great's flutist and teacher, and a friend of Telemann. And I'm thinking that he's also, you know, the exact calendrical contemporary of George Frederick Handel. And I think of Handel as being this great tone painter of matching words to music. But Zelenka did very much the same sort of thing, didn't he?
Yes. His music is filled with harmonic intensity, and really he's a master of counterpoint as well. And so in the Crucifixus of the Mass, for example, he creates a really solemn picture by making a theme, which is a sonic representation of the cross.
And you can actually hear the sign of the cross, you know, when you see Crucifixus.
Right? And you can actually see that and hear it in the music. The theme in the long notes is a cross motive. And so a somber character is created just by this and the counter subject which follows that.
And so that's visually in the score as well.
Yes, it is.
Well, yeah. Let's have a listen to that, and we'll hear talk more with Paul Flight about the Carl Bach Society and Zelenka.
Thank you.
from Zelenka's Misa Votiva, the section Crucifixus. Paul, we hear in that brief excerpt just already some of the very intricate harmonies that Zelenka is experimenting with, don't we?
Yeah, we certainly do. In some of the other sections, he really gets harmonically bold and daring. And I invite listeners to come to our concerts to discover some of the twists and turns that he does in the Mass. It's
and
very
so
cool.
That's actually another reason why at the end of his career he kind of fell out of favor, in spite of being at the epitome, the peak of Baroque writing. It was a tendency at that time to go towards the more simple.
That's right, a sort of a lighter style, the so-called Rococo style, where everything was tasteful and elegant, and not as daring and sort of grandiose in style. And so Zelenka's music didn't fall into that category.
Not so much, I imagine, with this 20-sectioned mass, but he was also one who incorporated Czech folk song into his works, like the person who championed him down the road, a fellow Bohemian, Bedřich Smetana.
Mm. Yeah, I don't have much experience with those kind of quotations, but it doesn't surprise me at all. Mm.
Well, I'd love to talk to you sometime about your conducting experience of Holst and Mio at Mills College, but I am going to look so much forward to this performance of the Zelenka Misa Votiva. It's tomorrow at here in San Francisco, Saturday at All Saints Episcopal Church in Palo Alto, and Sunday at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley. Let's hear a little bit more music of Zelenka, but not before I just thank you for coming in today and hope that you will accept my invitation to spend some more time shortly down the road.
Well, I look forward to it, David. Thanks for having me.
More music of Zelenka, which you can hear this weekend, calbach.org for more information. As you enjoy this music of Zelenka, we do have three pairs of tickets to offer to you to this Bohemian masterpiece, Zelenka's Misa Votiva, tomorrow evening, 8 o'clock, St. Mark's Lutheran Church here in San Francisco. 8 o'clock performance, 415-841-4134 if you'd like a pair of tickets to hear the Cal Bach Society do Zelenka's Misa Votiva, St. Mark's Lutheran Church, tomorrow evening at 8, a great space to hear some music. 415-841-4134. Music of Jan Dietmas Zelenka from his Misa Votiva. Tickets have been given away, I'm afraid, for tomorrow's performance. Thank you for calling St. Mark's Lutheran Church here in San Francisco. But you have an opportunity to catch the performances on Saturday at All Saints Episcopal Church in Palo Alto and Sunday at 4 p.m. at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley. Information about all of those performances at calbach.org. Good afternoon once again. I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air on Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. Some more tickets to give away, a pair, at least for this next segment, but do pause until I give you the cue to make those phones ring. Spreckles Theater Company in Rohnert Park takes audiences to Italy's Tuscan countryside for The Light in the Piazza, a 6 Tony Award-winning musical based on the 1950s novella by Elizabeth Spencer, with music and lyrics by Adam Gettle and a book by Craig Lucas. It runs through the 25th at Cotting Theatre in Spreckles Performing Arts Center in Rohnert Park. Soprano Jennifer Mitchell of Woodside, who received critical acclaim for her portrayal of Julie in the 2015 Spreckles Theatre Company production of Carousel, stars in this sophisticated and heartwarming musical, and I'm quoting, about truth, justice, and the American way. No, courage, trust, faith, and love. Her character is Clara, and she joins me in studio today. Jennifer has sung lead roles for 42nd Street Moon and Pocket Opera, for Lamplighters, as well as for Livermore Valley Operas, among many others. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. She's joined by Diego Garcia, music director of the production, who made his conducting debut at Spreckles with You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, and has since added many a notch to his musical baton. A fine singer as well, I might add. Welcome back to you, Diego.
Thank you so much.
And congratulations on the rave reviews already for Piazza. Must be very gratifying.
It's very exciting.
We're very excited that people are coming to see it and that more people will.
Well, I have to admit that this show is a bit off my radar in spite of its winning so many Tonys. So for myself, as well as others with my degree of ignorance, could you perhaps give us a brief synopsis? Jennifer's looking at Diego. Diego's looking at Jennifer. Those are not able to see what I'm seeing.
No, it's Light in the Piazza comes at a time in the Broadway vernacular when a lot of the music that had been written had been very story-based, exploring the inner workings of the human condition. And a lot of the music that was coming out in the early aughts really went from the words, and it was the cadence of language as opposed to melody. And Adam Gettle, in his score, really shifted the conversation back to melodicism, deep orchestration, and a love of the melody, which was a huge shift from what had been happening before. And as a result, we have more scores now that are being written with melody in mind. I mean, in the great tradition of the Rodgers and Hammerstein or any of the other great composers.
So let me hear about what your character goes through. You're playing the character Clara, is that right, Jennifer?
Yes. Clara and her mother, Margaret Johnson, go to Florence. They're doing a tour of Italy. Very predictably, Clara falls in love with a young Italian man named Fabrizio. And there's something a little different about Clara. For those who plan to come see the show, I won't reveal what that is, but they run into some challenges with that, with Fabrizio and his family, and her falling in love with this young man while they're there as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. Diego, could you tell us a little bit about the other wonderful singers that are involved in the production?
Well, we have a lot of extraordinary people who have come together. I mean, really from all over the place. I mean, Jennifer's coming all the way from Woodside. You know, it's quite a journey, but people are making a real effort because this show, as you said, it's not as known yet, kind of in the Sondheim vernacular of shows that are almost before their time. But under the leadership of the artistic director, Gene Aprovaia, he brought together a huge team, a huge, not in numbers, but in talent and in perseverance. So most importantly, I mean, for me, at least at the beginning, it was the pianist, which was Lucas Sherman, who coordinated all of the orchestra to get that extraordinary sound out of six. It's a chamber orchestra, but six musicians. And our tenor is Jacob Bronson. He comes from the East Bay, Oakland area, an extraordinary voice, and a wonderful person to work with. We also have Stephen Kent Barker, who had been working as a musician, touring all over the country, and then made a transition into acting because he had such a great personality. Playing Clara's mother, playing Margaret, is Eileen Morris, who has been seen all over the Bay Area for many years. She comes from the North Bay. And has been seen at Lamplighters, has been seen really, you know, all over the place, really just working so hard and contributing so much to Bay Area music.
I've not been up to the Spreckles Theater Company in the Coddington Theater. Could you tell me a little bit about the theater?
Yes, the as you know, so the name Spreckles, of course, is from the Spreckles fortune, Alma Spreckles. I mean, it's part of that same family, and they contributed money to create a 500-seat theater in the vicinity of Rohnert Park. It's a gloriously vast space, and so it's a joy to get to work in that space. But it's a full orchestra pit, a large proscenium, and it's all single-level seating, so it's a beautiful theater to get to play in.
And a 500-seat is just the right size for this kind of thing. I mean, it's intimate, yet you get a sense of community in that kind of a space.
Exactly, and the director decided for this time to move the action forward. He wanted it to be right there, right in the middle of it, as if you're a tourist in Italy and watching all of the life happen right in front of you. So he moved the orchestra back into we're in a cube behind the stage, but everyone is watching us, you know, with the electronics. We have cameras and all kinds of things to aid the singers. But
sure,
you just get the singers and get to hear the music and watch the drama unfold right in front of you.
Well, in reading about the production, I understand that there's some technology involved in helping bring those various Tuscan scenes to life.
Absolutely. Gene is known for the wonderful projections that he uses on the back of the stage. They're Paradigm projections, I believe they're called, and he has some beautiful projections of different Florentine landscapes, which are really lovely. And then we also have the technology element of having monitors on which we're watching Diego conduct, since he's not in front of us. And since it's a very challenging score musically, we definitely need to be in touch with him so that we stay together with the orchestra. So we have one right in front of us, but way up, and then two that are off to the side.
Mm-hmm. Well, knowing you, Diego, and your love for musicals, after Piazza, what would be your dream musical to conduct or to direct?
Well, fortunately, the Spreckles Theatre Company has decided to do a work that doesn't get done as much either. It's the musical Kismet, with those extraordinary scores and music by Alexander Borodin. They're going to do a staged concert version of it in January, mm-hmm. February. And so they've asked me to come on as musical director.
Very nice. How about you, Jennifer?
I've been lucky enough to do two of the shows that I've dreamed of doing, Light in the Piazza being one of them. I didn't think it would get done, since it is done very infrequently. So it has been worth it for me to make the trek up to Rohnert Park to get to do this role. And Julian Carousel was another one that I have dreamed of doing. I would love to play Maria in The Sound of Music. That's on my list. Belle and Beauty and the Beast. Lots of those fun roles.
Oh, good. Well, keep us informed as they come your way.
Absolutely, I will.
Let's hear some of the music of Mr. Gettle, Adam Gettle. But before we do, Diego, I understand that this composer, I didn't realize, has quite a bit of history behind him.
Yes, he does. He's definitely related to one of the great composers of the Broadway stage. A different last name. But I think we have a pair of
tickets to offer to people up in Rohnert. If you're interested in the Spreckles Theater production of Rohnert in Rohnert Park, of The Light in the Piazza. Adam Gettle, related to a very historied name in Broadway. If you can maybe offer that name, or if you can't, just give us a call here at 841-4134, 415-841-4134. I'll give you a little hint. The grandfather's initials are RR. He was coupled with another famous person involved in Broadway for many years, or several people.
That's right.
Indeed.
That's right.
Well, let's hear some music from Music in the Piazza, and I thank you both for coming in. Information about the production is at SprecklesOnline.com. Here's music from the original Broadway cast recording of The Light in the Piazza. Music by Adam Gettle with a book by Craig Lucas. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All I see, the light in the piazza, the light in the piazza. It's rushing up, it's pouring out, it's flying through the air, over the air. Who knows what you call it, but it's there.
Beautiful music and lyrics by Adam Gettle from The Light in the Piazza up at the Spreckles Theater Company in Rohnert Park. Just to let you guys know, that famous relation of Adam Gettle, Richard Rogers, his grandfather. You can definitely hear a little bit of music in Adam's genes, that's for sure. Again, information about this production at SprecklesOnline.com. From the soundtrack of Midnight Cowboy, cryptically, I'm introducing for our regular contributor, Peter Robinson. So why that music, Peter?
Well, good to be here, David. And I'm going to be talking about a book called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. It's by Sherry Turkle. And believe me, it has set Silicon Valley talking most of this week. And when I say talking, I'm talking about face-to-face talk. I'm talking about talking real live conversations in real time. So this is in Silicon Valley where we don't talk, we text, we tweet, we Facebook, we email, we instant message, we snapshot or snapshoot, as the case may be. And I think the over-reliance on these devices is something that she points out is coming at an expense of our ability to have a valuable face-to-face conversation, the most human of all things to do. Now, I'm pleased to say here at KLW, in the course of the last 50 minutes, we've had four meaningful face-to-face conversations. We've had exchanges about music, about theatre, about dancing, about movies. So Sherry Turkle, at least, would be relieved to know that conversation is well and alive here at 91.7 FM. And the importance of looking a person in the face, having that face-to-face contact, is the difference between the cell phone, instant messaging, and some of these other devices that she has reported on in her book. Now, she is a distinguished professor at MIT. She's a psychiatrist, a teacher of sociology courses, and for the past 30 years, she has concentrated on the way that we communicate. So she brings to her audience, to her readers, a really rich background in understanding what some of the consequences of being wired. And one of the consequences of being wired all the time is that we lose our sense of empathy. And she defines empathy as putting yourself in the place of another person and imagine essentially what they are going through. And I think this is why this book is important in this particular age. Another consequence she identifies is the loss of attention. And there is a generation growing up now that literally does not look each other in the eye. In fact, when it comes to defining that a very important word, friendship, the contact of these electronic virtual friendships gives it a different sense of meaning. And I think that is her concern. And these are not just intuitive guesses. She's done excessive testing at camps where there are literally technical, device-free weeks. You spend a week together without your cell phone. And they then have found a way of measuring the empathy gene, and the consequence is that people do become more empathetic. They become to understand each other. And they say, you know, to be a friend, or to have a friend, you have to be a friend. And that means being with somebody, not necessarily being with them electronically. And I think that's why this distinction that she comes up with is going to be a book very much for our time. Now, even as a journalist, although I like to check the time of trains, planes, departures, I find myself I can't live just electronically. And I've created my own little vocabulary just to keep me in touch. When people speak to each other constantly on the cell phone, they become cellmates, and that automatically means they're captured by their phone.
I'll create a new lexicon of Peter Robinson. Let's hear another.
And when they all go off together, all these phones, then we have pandophonia. And that, of course, creates endless trouble.
I think that's related to sell-off.
To sell-off is bad, but even worse is cellulitis. And that is when you catch the disease and now you can't leave it alone. And, of course, I think this is where they should award, here we go, a Nobel Prize for the phone that didn't ring. It simply vibrated.
I think it's a no-ring prize.
A no-ring. Ding-a-ling, no-ring. So I highly recommend the book. I'm going to give the title again. It's called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age. And in all honesty, she does not have a solution. So this is a book about warning where we could go if we forget what it's like to sit down next to a person. And of course, here's the key word, listen. And that takes me back, of course, to Midnight Cowboy. Everybody is talking about me, but I don't hear a word they say. Only the solitude of my mind. And that, to me, speaks about what Shirley Turkle is talking about. The book, The Power of Reclaiming Conversation and the Power of Talk in the Digital Age.
Well, thank you for that, Peter. We look forward to your next dispatch here at KLW for Open Air.
So the other thing I've been up to this week, because the seasons are changing, and although we still have what is like a mini Indian summer going on here in the Bay Area, it's a good time to start walking. And the San Francisco libraries have an interesting program called San Francisco Walks, where with a historian and a guide, you can trundle through a neighborhood. So this last couple of weeks, I've been on two walks through North Beach, the perhaps one of the most interesting and colorful parts of the city. My first guide definitely was a good historian. And as we left the new North Beach Library, which has just been built in the last year, a great place to use just as a meeting spot, we headed down Columbus and stopped off at Cafe Roma. Now, the reason I mention Cafe Roma is they've actually got the grinding machines where the beans are ground, and you suddenly get the full fragrance of what coffee really should taste like. As a journalist, as a travel writer, I think the best way to discover a city is on your feet. You get the smells, you get the noises, you get the sights, you get the sounds, and of course, if you're into people gazing, you see the people. And believe me, you can see it all in North Beach. A couple of the myths you learn that need to be dispelled. Myth number one, that Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe were married at St. Peter and Paul's, the huge church on the corner of Washington Square. They were married downtown at the town hall and then moved to the steps for the photo shoot. So there we are, even though Joe DiMaggio himself was a part-time resident. Wander across the square there and you'll see older Chinese people doing Tai Chi. Makes a great photograph, and again, importance of going slowly. Tai Chi is not for the high-speed track runner. In the middle of the square is the statue of Benjamin Franklin, surrounded by beautiful linden trees, and there's a good story to go with that. Now, the word beach, I think, is also important, because originally this was a beach. It was filled with landfill in the 1900s, and then gradually became its second name, Little Italy, since Italian immigrants moved in there. But again, part of these walks is to see how a neighbourhood undergoes changes. And as you approach Chinatown, you see the growing influence and spread of Chinese immigrants who came in the next phase, so the neighborhood is changing. But beyond that are the old jazz clubs, a walk down Grant Street, individual boutiques in a world where big major corporations are taking over. Here are simple shopping shops. And of course, if you like pizza, North Beach Inn, North Beach is North Beach, and that means pizza. So I highly recommend taking one of these two different types of tours. One is a food tour. If you check out Local Tastes on the net, you'll find a reference to that. And this gives you a guided tour of the different fragrances, flavors, and tastes that you'll find as you wander down Columbus Avenue. And then secondly, the library tours, which really give you a history. They give you that sense of what Columbus Avenue used to be like, what it's like today, and how, in terms of sociological change, populations and demographics have come to really make a neighborhood a thriving community and a place to be visited. Go to your local library, check it out, and enjoy a walking tour in our nice springtime, summertime, November weather.
Before the rains come, indeed. Thanks, Peter, for those recommendations. We'll see you again soon.
Good. Good to be here, David. Thank you.
As we listen to the overture, final strands of Adam Gattell's marvelous overture to music, to The Light and the Piazza, let me just tell you about a couple other things that are coming up in addition to everything that you've heard on this jam-packed edition of Open Air. This Saturday is Community Day at the DeYoung. It's a free day and night at the DeYoung Museum, celebrating 10 years of the new building, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. And a reminder that that spectacular view from the tower is always free at the DeYoung. Sunday, my colleague Sarah Cahill on Revolutions Per Minute will have Kaija Saariaho as her guest. The Finnish composer's La Terna Magica was featured on last night's Berklee Symphony Orchestra opening concert. And speaking of Sarah, Monday evening, join me for Explorations in Music as we continue our exploration of the music of Mozart in his final days in Vienna with music historian Robert Greenberg and the Alexander String Quartet. Sarah will be guest to perform the piano quartet in E-flat, Kerschel 493 from 1786. And join me next week on Open Air. Susanna Malky will be the guest conductor of the San Francisco Symphony next week. She'll stop in. We'll also have some Baroque oboe and strings discussion with Carla Moore and playwright Lauren Gunderson on next week's Open Air. A reminder that all of our shows are archived at kalw.org. If you've got a local group that you'd like featured on Open Air, send me an email, david@kalw.org. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air and getting our calendar situated. Again, thanks for listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio. Coming up next, it's an hour of news from the BBC. Stay tuned and enjoy these final moments of Adam Gattell, grandson of Richard Rodgers and composer of The Light and the Piazza at Rohnert Performing Arts Center.